Good morning and welcome to AV Daybreak. I'm Mark Coxon, and as always, I'm here with Jared Hillman, who's navigating snow. Jared?
Just a bit of snow. And it's, you know, like I was saying, every year I'm just caught off guard by the traffic. It's just, everyone acts like it's the first time they've ever seen it. Like they're in a winter wonderland. It just, I don't know. It just blows my mind. Every year, people. Every year this happens.
That reminds me of when I lived in Arizona. It was like that with rain. It's like people would be like, water's falling from the sky. And they pull over to the side of the road and they'd stop there with their fists clenched, staring up into the clouds. Wondering if the world was going to end.
I started thinking about when I was driving here and I was thinking about Canadian winter traffic. And then it started making me think of the California traffic reports and stuff.
Yes.
Or the California traffic comments that we always make. And so in my own head, I started like, you can't drive 50 miles with an inch of snow, man. You can't drive without winter tires, man. It just started making, I just started getting this weird Canadian traffic mixed with California.
The Canadians. You can't get off near Regina, Stewart.
Yeah. You can't take that exit when it snowed. They're icing. They're de-icing. They're standing. Anyways, that's a deep rabbit hole we can go down. Traffic.
Yes, on the twos and on the nines. We haven't been doing traffic on the twos and on the nines. Actually, here we've got traffic again, which is putting a damper on my – honestly, on my desire to be out and about. Like about 6 months ago, I came back from Malibu, and Malibu to my house, for people that don't know California, is probably about 70 miles. And I got home in an hour and 15 minutes. And I'm like, wow, Malibu to my house is usually about a 3.5 hour drive through LA traffic.
It's that significant.
Yeah, it was like a 3X.
You can't get home in an hour from Malibu.
By helicopter you can, which is why some people who can afford to do that. I remember, I think it was the president of Sony flew into LA and asked the California Department of Transportation if they could clear the 405 for him to get from LAX to wherever he was going in like Torrance or Long Beach or somewhere. They wanted them to close a freeway.
And they were like,
millions
no,
of people.
We're good.
Yeah. They're like, we're nah. Good. No,
what's the population of California?
I don't know. I wish I was smart enough to know that. I have no.
Like
it's over a million. I think it's over 30, a million. 30,
like more than Saskatchewan or less? What would you say?
I would say more than Saskatchewan. If I was doing my over under, it's more than Saskatchewan.
I guess we'll never know.
It's a hot topic of debate. Yeah. Well, hey, I am excited about this morning. And one reason that I'm excited is, you know, someone reached out to us, Jared, and said, hey, I like your show. Like, if you ever need somebody, I'd love to come on. And I, you know, after calling my relatives to see if they were pranking me, I figured out that it was actually like a real email.
It was cool.
It was really cool. And so I called you and I said, what do you think of this? And after you regained consciousness, we thought it was
100%.
100%. So I'm going to call Steve Greenblatt.
Yes, you are.
So let's see where he's at. Steve.
Hey guys.
Hey man, how are you doing?
What's up, Steve?
Good to talk to you guys.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have you on because, number one, you know, like, we like attention and we're, you know, putting this podcast out to our, what'd you say, we have 11, Jared, 11 listeners?
I think I saw 12, but my mom might have unfollowed us, and so.
Oh, okay.
We're back down to 11.
We're back down to 11. 11's a magic number. Well, yeah. I thought we were going to get to a baker's dozen, but now we can't even fill an egg carton again.
But it is cool that, yeah, I mean, we feel honored to have, you know, especially significant people like Steve reach out to us and say, hey, I'd love to be part of that show.
Yeah, Steve.
I think that's cool.
You're with Control Concepts, Inc. I believe it's your company, but which is awesome. I don't usually do this, but you know, for those out there that don't know Control Concepts, your elevator pitch, what do you guys do?
So we're an independent programming company, which is what people know us as an entity in the industry. But what we are is we're a group of software developers that work in the control space. We work with this, several of the control system platforms. We work with integrators and end users and consultants and help them and their clients make systems work together. And we also work with manufacturers and we develop modules and drivers so that their products are easier for programmers and integrators to work with.
Gotcha. So I have used companies like yours in the past. I remember I had my first commercial job coming from residential, which, wow, I'm having PTSD just thinking about why I would thought that as a residential integrator, we could take a large commercial project. But
you're not alone. You're not alone. That happens all the time.
Well, I knew it too. The funny part was I knew it. And the company I was working for at the time back in 2007 said, just bring it in, Mark. We'll figure it out. Just bring it in. We're going to support you. We have Crestron programmers on staff here in California. You know, we need that business. Make sure you go get it and bring it back here. And we will circle the wagons operationally to make sure you're taken care of. Brought in the work and said, yeah, nobody from California wants to come and live in Arizona for 2-3 weeks to do that job with you. So why don't you just find some people to do it there? Like, wait, what happened to my support? Anyways, we ended up with a box from Analog Way, which is like a big edge blending, video processor. And we had a Crestron control system in there, surprise. And there was no module for the box that we were using. So there was, we had to hire somebody, probably like you do, Steve, to dig into that box, figure out what the programming language was and all that kind of stuff, and figure out how to write some code to control it through a touch panel. So
it's becoming more and more of a need, especially as we're working toward providing solutions that are easier to implement. So somebody's got to do the hard work somewhere, and doing the modules and drivers is really where some of the magic happens, because the devices aren't getting any easier to work with. So that connector needs to happen especially as we talk more about configuration, modules and drivers are really critical, and the manufacturers actually are stepping up to realize that more and more, and are looking at it as part of their product development these days, so that when they put something out, they say, hey, you know what, we don't know who's out there and who's going to be using this. We have to appeal to the masses. So here's also the driver or module that you need to make this work.
And that module driver from I think is, it can be misleading as well. I can tell you from a sales standpoint that I used to think, what do you mean you can't make this work? There's a driver for it. And so driver module doesn't necessarily mean that you have full control of that device, does it?
That definitely true. It's actually one of the things that we talk about, because you can do, we've termed it like a skinny module, and it's basically, these are the functions you need to make the device work today for this instance or for this project, not necessarily this is what you're going to need to make it work for the majority of the projects that you're going to work with. I mean, right. We're not going to include every function. Typically, you know, it's same as like you wouldn't include every button on a remote control, but it's that we want to appeal to that 80% case.
Wait, you mean if you're doing like touch panel design and control, you don't put you don't have like 17 page flips with every single function? I have seen systems like that.
Well, if you follow some consultant specs to the T, you would be doing that.
Yes.
Many of them say to include every function.
Yes, every single function. We want the mute button exactly next to the volume buttons, like on the remote control.
Yep. And we also want those, we also want the red, green, yellow, and blue buttons. We don't know what they do, but we want those too.
Yes. Are those Samsung buttons? Aren't the colored buttons?
I think those are Samsung. Yeah, those are typically Samsung.
The red, green, yellow, and blue buttons. That's right.
Yeah.
I think they're to adjust the CRT tube on the TV. you can adjust the you can adjust the level of the electron.
Just what you want to give a user.
Yeah, here's the ability to throw off the color space in the device.
So I was just going to go into the interface side, because you do the back end work. Do you guys also provide services? Do you also get into the user interface side then, Steve?
Yeah. Part of it is designing the solution. So
okay.
And we've over the years, some of our team is more equipped to do that better than others. But we also try to come up with what we would say would be a typical approach. And we've developed some samples that we start with, and it's not a template or anything of that nature, but a guideline that we present to a client and say, okay, this is a modern approach that we found works, and what do you think of it, and show them how we would apply it to what they need.
If you have an employee that can do all the back end programming and coding, as well as an amazing, beautiful graphical interface, is that a real person or is that a unicorn? Because I find that there are very two distinct type of programmers, right? Some do have a very strong focus on the graphical side. They might not be as strong on, and I think it's because it's two different parts of your brain, right? One has to think logical and do all that back end, and the other is your creative side. So is that considered a unicorn in your industry? When you have someone that can really excel at both, because I'm going to be honest, I've never seen someone that's excessively strong at both.
So I would say that yes, it's a challenge for a lot of people, but there are ways to overcome it, and I think part of it comes in one of the things that I talk about a lot is that control programming, it's hard to be the guy that does it. You really need to work as a team, because you can't know everything. You need a buddy to help you troubleshoot or share experiences with, and having a team of programmers, their collective experience gives you a lot of resources to work with. So that's one of the things that we do. But another thing to add to what you were saying is the third component is the operation. So it's you want the UI to look good, and these days simpler seems to be what people are looking for.
Yes.
So the graphic side isn't even as big of a deal, even though throughout the years it has been. But it's that clean, simple look, but it's the operation that that really, I think, gives it that the extra buzz and the wow factor, making it being able to plan for all the cases that you're going to need, and have easy transitions between modes and know where to add when systems expand or change.
Right.
You never want to paint yourself into a corner. But to answer your question, one way of doing that too is to be able to have somebody who can present at least a wireframe. So maybe you're not the graphics guy, but you can at least say, okay, this is the operation of the system. We can then give it to somebody else that can make it look nice.
Yeah, I think. It's interesting, because with the advent of smartphone, obviously everybody's got a touch panel in their hand every day, and they have a base level expectation of what things look like, right? Like, we know what a nice app or a good user interface looks like now. And the amount of money that goes into consumer app development is obviously huge, right? There's a lot of money that goes into that clients aren't going to spend on their own space when they're doing something for one off or for one company. But that doesn't matter in the background when they have that kind of base level expectation. So people start to gravitate towards that real simple, clean. When you were talking, it reminded me of something, and I don't know. I need to start doing this more potentially with my clients. And I don't know if it's something you've ever tried, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. I was reading a book. I think it was called Decisive, by Dan and Chip Heath. So they made a book on how to make better decisions, or how to help people make better decisions. And when you were talking about kind of these reviews and wireframes and all of these things, they're saying that you can actually get a better net result usually by multi-tracking. So maybe I said this on one of the AVU day breaks before. I don't know. I'm going to say it again. So this idea of multi-tracking. So let's say you're going to go to a customer and you're going to propose an interface. So instead of going in and proposing one interface or one wireframe, you go in and you propose three. I say, these are three different ways that I could accomplish this project. From that, people will say, oh, I like this about this one, and I like these two things about this one, and I like the way that this one does this, or this one I hate altogether, and I like these two, but could we take this piece? And then when you go to your reiteration, you go down to two, and then when you go to the next iteration, you go down to one. And so you've really done those six designs, but you didn't do them in a linear way. As I said, what happens is if you go in with this linear way, the person, the programmer, the designer, whoever that was, like talking about websites or any of these things, they get emotionally invested in that, the time they put into that one design. And the feedback they get, they're somewhat resistant to, because these are their ideas on paper and that's the only idea they're presenting. So they start to dig in heels on certain ideas. So the next iteration doesn't quite get there. And they go through those same six, but in that linear process, they don't get close enough to where the customer would have been as if they would have done the six by presenting three first and narrowing down. So the point was that the pre-work, you know, sometimes that pre-work is work that's hard to put in because you don't have the job yet or the customer, but that pre-work actually may create that much better result in the end that gets you, you know, the repeat client, the better experience and all those things that, you know, we're trying to provide as service providers. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It popped in my head. It was weird.
Yeah, I like that idea actually a lot, quite a bit. I think I'm going to share it with my team. It's really a great idea. And I like the fact that you don't get too emotionally invested. So you're not taking the feedback personally.
Yeah.
You're just saying, okay, these are some choices. What do you like and what don't you like? And that's one of the things that I think is far more effective than just starting out and saying, what do you want?
Yeah,
it's kind of like your. It's kind of like the flags we were talking about with budgets as well. You're almost planting your flags in the same sense with the design, right? Like, because when we were talking about budgets, we were talking about budgets and we were talking about how you just start saying, hey, how do you feel about this? How do you feel about this dollar amount? How do you feel about this dollar amount? And so, are you saying you're going to do the same? You want to do the same thing, Mark, with clients where instead of saying, hey, how do you want this system to work? You're saying, how do you feel about this operation or this option? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, somewhat. And I'll tell you, I think we don't do it quite to the full extent on the furniture side of our business, but I've sat through some design reviews with designers and clients on like the furniture side when we're talking about something very aesthetic and design centric. Now, a UI is really very aesthetic and design centric as well. I mean, and when we're talking about what people like and how they're going to navigate it, right, or what their preferences are. But when I sit through those design meetings with the furniture folks in my company, they've put together a CAD file, and they've populated it with colors and textures. But as they go from office to office, they've had a conversation with the client. They kind of know what their needs are and what they're looking for and kind of what their base budgets expectations are. But when they go through, they're like, so in this office, we used, you know, like these textures and these kind of lines, because you said you liked this, you said you liked that. What do you think of this? And that's just the open-ended question. What do you think of this room? Oh, I hate that chair. I really like the desk. I like the wood finishes, but I think that's too clunky, or I like the clean line of that, but could we do that in an L instead of a straight, because I put papers on the side? And then they just start taking notes. And they're not invested in anything in that room. And then they may go to another office, the other executive office, and it's got other options in it. And then at the back, typically there is a page of like, in that office, we used this chair, this couch, this desk. Here are six other chairs, six other couches, and six other desks that we think also could meet your needs, that as just examples of what else they could have put in there. But they can only put one in the CAD file, but they'll put those pictures there. And so then when people start saying, well, I like that chair, but I'd like it to be bigger, or I'd like it to be blue, or I think I want arms on it, and no arms. They're like, oh, there's an armed version. They flip to the page, they show all the ones with arms. Oh yeah, I do like that one. Or, oh, I like the one next to it better. And so they come in with this, they come in with a suggestion, and the suggestion is based on the feedback of the customer, but they're not sold on this has to be the way that it lays out. They're really looking for open-ended feedback, and then they have all of those options available then to start narrow down what that next piece is, so that the next iteration is a much better representation. So they almost kind of go into that first meeting going, clients, this isn't it. They know it's not it going in. They just know it's their best guess of what it may be, and that they're going to go through probably two more before they get to where they need to go. It's just a really cool process to watch. You know, I've also seen interior designers do it on homes. And one that I saw do it was very interesting. They just throw all the furniture in with the price tags. So they go put all the stuff in the house that they would design with the house. And then they tell the customer, go around and remove the price tag from everything you want to keep. And the person goes around the house, pulls the stuff they like, leaves price tags on stuff they don't, come back through. Why didn't you like this? Where do you want something here? Do you not? Oh, no, I'd much rather have like an ottoman that's soft on top instead of hard. Okay, cool. And they go through and then they redo it again. but just this idea of that, you know, letting the customer choose, it might be a little foreign for some AV folks, right? Like, I think sometimes we dig in that we're the experts and all our other clients like this. Why don't you like it? Why do I need to change it for you?
Yeah, I think that is a challenge in AV control, especially because when you've done an entire system, typically the client has little to no care about what the actual system components are, but the minute they go to use that interface and it's cumbersome or it doesn't make sense, or, you know, they don't understand why this button is here or why this button is called what, that's where all the fun begins. So Steve, if you do the interface side as well, from your experience, and I know that this is always a challenge, I think, even like in our company you kind of talked about it, Mark, is all that pre-work, right? I think that's the thing that integration always challenges themselves with, is there's like an expectation of so much pre-work, and then there's the actual required pre-work to actually provide an accurate proposal and a concept, because, you know, it does get challenging to not do certain things and still provide an accurate proposal. So in your experience, Steve, how have you gone about developing an interface based on best practice client feedback? Do you do kind of what you guys have spoken about, where you might take three or four different layouts that you've used in the past and say, hey, you know, which ones of these do you like? How does this sit? How does this suit you? How do you guys go about developing that so that you kind of only do it, you know, do it right or do it twice kind of thing?
So I guess rewinding a little bit to what Mark said, and I think it has to be a collaborative process, you know, and I think that clients are becoming more and more interested and involved and also becoming more active part of the industry. So I think we have to take their views and their input, and also some of them do what we do, so they understand, you know, but to answering your question, you first have to start with what do they have? Because sometimes no matter what we think or would work best for them, if they are invested in a standard or they have layouts that they know that they either like or they're committed to, that's our starting point. But when we get a chance to redesign or come to it with a clean slate, that's when we have to rely on our past experience, and we've learned throughout the years what clients telling us they like and they don't like, and we and many times it's iteration too, as has been discussed. For us, when you have a bigger project, when you're doing tens or sometimes, you know, 100 rooms, that's when it's a lot easier to be able to incorporate a design process within the scope. When you're in a single room, it's a little bit harder, I think, to be able to budget for that. But when you're doing a bigger scope, that's when you also have to be looking at things that are just beyond a particular room or application. You have to be looking at a big picture, and you have to say, we actually just had a conversation with a client yesterday, is that you have to design for almost the biggest application that they're doing, and then funnel it down from there. because if we want to maintain consistency, which is a big thing that clients want, we have to know how do we design our most populated system, and then how do we design our least populated system, not so that one looks empty and one looks full, but so that we have a nice blend and make sure that the operation is going to be seamless for them. So it definitely depends on a case by case scenario.
You know what I'm hearing too, and Jared, we have a knack for doing this. You know, Steve, you started this company in 97, right?
Yeah.
So 23 years doing this. I've got to imagine, you know, I'm sure there are programmers in the industry that have been doing their job 20, 30 years, typically probably not in the same spot. And what happens is they have to kind of bend or move with the philosophy of whatever company that they work with at the time. But having the freedom as a business owner to kind of have 23 years of experience doing this, see the overall kind of global shifts between different customers, because you're supporting manufacturers, you're supporting integrators, you're supporting equipment across verticals and across different pieces. You kind of get this aerial view of the world that maybe other people just don't get. And so that it seems like a lot of the value is in that 23 years of seeing some of everything and knowing what has been successful in those situations in the past, right? I mean, that accumulated knowledge of 23 years has to be a huge asset to somebody like you.
It certainly is. The other thing that's kind of special is that we're put into all these different types of situations. So because we don't have control over the design of the equipment that we work with, we're purely responsible for the system operation and programming and the functionality. We're thrown into many different types of scenarios and have to adapt. So we could work with integrators that are very skilled, or some that may not have all of the skills required. We work with different types of end users and consultants, and also have seen the needs change over that time. It used to be that we were wanting a Windows-based interface, right? Because that's what everybody knew and thought was easy. And then we went to the iPhone, and now we're into Zoom. Everybody is saying we want our system, because everybody uses Zoom, that's what they know, make our operation be like Zoom. That's most popular request right now.
Wow. I hadn't thought about the Zoom interface as the new kind of like bellwether for what simplicity was. That's interesting. I know the reason those dots started to connect for me, I get a lot of people who ask me sometimes, I'll make statements about the way people do things, or I'll make statements about how I think people perceive, you know, technology or certain things like that. And I had a couple engineers challenge me once and say, what study did you read that told you that, or where did you get that data from? And I really had to stop and think, because I'm making statements in a semi-authoritative way. And I honestly got back to, you know what, like in 2002 through 2007, when I did residential AV, at peak there, I was meeting 2,000 people a year and helping them design their homes. And these were people that were everyone from, you know, we did Toll Brothers, D.R. Horton, and Shea, and we did Shea Homes was active adult, so 55 plus. And so I had brand new homeowners, I had executives buying 10,000 square foot homes, and I had people buying second or third homes, especially in the mid 2000s, shared a lot of Canadians buying homes in Arizona. I think there must have been a good exchange rate or something at the time, but
there was.
The way that worked, and I just thought about it, and I'm like, you know what? I didn't read it somewhere. It's just it's meeting 8 to 10,000 people over those 5 years, talking to them about how they live and what they want and how they received things and the way that I said them, and daily tweaks on that really came out to, you know, 7 years is what provided that. You know, not any one thing I read. So I can imagine that 23 years probably yields even more of a piece there.
I just got an image of Mark talking to this engineer, and the engineer says, "How did you even come up with that information? Like, what study did you read?" And then Mark just goes, all political. You know, I think about the homeowner in Arizona and Tucson that I was talking to the other day. He was unhappy because he couldn't start his microwave from his touch panel. And I said, why can't we start our microwaves from our touch panel in America? And so now I assume everyone in Tucson, Arizona wants to start their microwave from their touch panel. You know,
it was a mistake to say make microwaves controllable again. That's where I went off the rails. Yeah. It was too close to something else.
Make microwaves.
Somebody got mad at me. It created a lot of like tension.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're right. Yeah. That's probably what I did. I probably waxed philosophical. You know, I met Katie down in Joe's Cafe in Scranton.
Yeah. And she was telling me.
Exactly. She was
AV for the middle class.
Why can't it be for everybody? Come
That's
on.
That's right. Why
they're getting left behind. hey, Steve, I want to ask you something, you know, little less about, you know, the programming so much, but as a business owner over the last 6-9 months, what's been your biggest challenge? You know, kind of going through besides, you know, a dip in business, which I think everybody has, but from a managing people side or from a, you know, managing the business side, what do you think has been the hardest lesson you had to learn, or maybe something that 23 years hadn't taught you yet, even though you'd been through a recession before? What's I guess stuck out to you this time?
The responsibility of having a team and knowing that people are putting their trust in you and that you have employees that you have to worry about their welfare and their well-being and knowing that they know less than you in terms of an outlook and they're hearing a lot of information and there's a lot of concerns and a lot of fears and being able to be a leader. I think that was the big challenge. It was really hard to be a leader. And I think also visibility and information. So they're asking you to give them some type of direction or some type of a path. And without knowing that much yourself, because of the things changing literally on a daily basis, it was really hard to be able to do that. And there's also that fine line between being completely transparent and causing people to be fearful in those situations. And I tend to be as transparent as possible, but I've been in situations, as you've mentioned throughout the years, where we've hit difficult times. And because I was honest about it, I lost employees because they jumped ship.
Yeah.
So it's also a challenge in that regard, because you want them to have their trust in you. And that's a lot of responsibility, because you have to make sure that you're going to lead them through the fire. You're going to lead them in a direction that's it's going to hopefully be prosperous. But sometimes you don't know yourself. Many times you don't know yourself.
Yeah. Do you think go ahead, Jared.
It just reminded me of an article that I read a while ago. And it was, I think the article was like, now is not the time for military leadership. And I read it and it was very, you know, having a little bit of military experience myself, and you know, you look at authors like Simon Sinek, who has based, you know, a lot of his mantras and theories and concepts on military leadership, especially like Leaders Eat Last is all based on military leadership. But what was interesting about it is it tried to strip away the value of being a strong leader and someone that's gung-ho. And it was just a really interesting article, because it was about how it was a negative time to be military style leadership. And exactly what Steve said is I commented back on this article and I said, this isn't true. Military style leadership is almost what you need right now, because like Steve said, you need people that they don't know what's going to happen right now, but they certainly can't let on to the team that, yeah, hey, this is all going under, abandon ship, abandon ship. You know, you have to find that balance of where you are carrying that hope and that courage and that will to keep pushing forward. And you're telling everyone behind you or with you that it's going to be okay. We're going to figure it out, you know? And so I like that you brought up the balance, Steve, because that's what I've found too, is the balance of not letting panic ensue, but not being arrogant either. Right. Like you have to find that middle ground. So,
you know,
military style leadership, people get it.
You know what I think?
Has it? You get it.
Listening to you, Jared, I think that article might've been written by somebody who maybe wasn't in the military, because it sounds like there's a misconception about military leadership. And, you know,
it 100% was a misconception.
Yeah. That military leaders just give orders. You follow them because I said so. I'm not having any human level of connection with somebody. It's I'm the boss and you're not, and you're going to run up the hill because I told you to run up the hill, and I'm not going to tell you what your odds of success are. I'm not going to explain to you why I have 10 years experience doing this and why you should be confident that what I'm telling you to do is going to yield a good result. But I don't believe that. I believe that the human side comes through in military leadership too, right? So almost what you're describing is pretty much what happened at our company, honestly. Like what Steve was saying about being, you know, being available and transparent in certain ways. You know, our CEO, for the first few weeks, every Thursday, we had a meeting on the state of the company, you know, and he would come through and say, hey, this is where we're at. We're in a good cash position. We've managed through two recessions before. We got hit in 2000. We got hit in 2007. I can't tell you exactly how long this is going to last or exactly what's going to happen here, but I can tell you that in the past, these are the things that we've done. And as leaders, we came out of it on the other side, with a stronger company than we had going in. You know, maybe it gave us a chance to fix some things. Maybe some of the people that were going to leave left. Some people may leave. They might have left anyway. You know, like he kind of went through that whole thing, but the way that he did it was creating this kind of open dialogue. If you ever have questions, make sure you come to one of us. Gave people the ability to kind of determine what their safety levels were in their work and all of those things, what their comfort levels were on when they returned and those pieces, but always kind of that quiet confidence that we've managed through this before and we'll manage through this again. It's not killing us. And, you know, that we know, we may not know exactly what's going to happen, but we have been proven to respond appropriately to crisis in the past. And I think just that, you know, like just that to say, you know, I tell kids in my class, like they start punching at me and stuff. I'm like, dude, I've been hit with malice. Like, because they'll apologize, they'll slap me or something in kickboxing, and they'll get really scared. I'm like, dude, I've been hit with malice by somebody who wanted to hurt me. Like, you know, and just having that, like, I'm not afraid of getting hit once or twice by somebody who's not really trying to hurt me right now. You know, like it's okay, it's gonna happen. But just having that courage under fire, I think, really helps set the boat straight. You know.
Yeah, I think the author of that article imagines everyone as like Gunnery Sergeant Hartman from like Full Metal Jacket, you know, and so that's what they consider military style leadership. But
I love the smell of COVID in the morning.
So how big is your team, Steve?
We're nine people right now, so we're six on the technical side, and I consider myself not on the technical side, even though I come from the technical side, and so I have three on the sales, marketing, administrative side, including me.
Okay. That's great. So you're about the same size as you're pretty close to the size of our company. Mark, what's the size of your team that you lead there? About four or five, isn't it?
My sales team, sales only have three people besides me. So we're a four person sales team total. So the team is small that I lead. Our division is more like 18, 20 people, but I don't lead the ops side. Although I'm very visible because I'm at the director level. So people do still kind of look to see how I'm reacting to things and what I'm doing many times within the company. And I think it's interesting now because I think we're starting to see that, you know, in order for us to hold top line revenues, we really need to make sure that we're maximizing every single division we have. I mean, we have a construction trades division that does flooring and TIs and electrical. We have the main division, which is steel case furniture. We do customized furniture for companies that have really unique looks or you know, workplaces that they just can't find anything on out of the catalogs to purpose. I think they're getting, a lot of people are starting to look to us to say, okay, where is technology telling us the market is going? because people are leaning into tech first before they decide, you know, they're leaning into tech now to bridge the gap. So do we have a window to add some value to where we see companies going in the future based on what they're using now to bridge the gap, right?
Steve, did you pivot, as everyone wants to say? Or did you do the same thing where you kind of looked at what you were doing and then said, okay, here's an opportunity during this time, here's what we can do? And if so, what did you guys, what kind of changes did you make?
So it's funny because fortunately we've been in the middle of a long pivot for a while, where we were just doing control programming and just working on projects and being very tied to the typical role that an independent programmer would be. In about 10 years ago, we started to look at this more from a software development side, where we were looking at other languages, and I started to think that with the help of Jeff Mackey, who's now our CTO, he's helped to develop a team that has more of a software development mindset and a software development perspective. And we moved away from just having your traditional control system programmer to somebody who can be a lot more versatile, because again, don't know what opportunities or what needs we're going to have to tackle. And we also, the other change that we made probably about 3 years ago was that we were stopped limiting our staffing to being local, and we started to look just for good people. And so we became more virtual, and we also, and honestly, it's scary, but I would say about 2 years ago, I almost got a bigger office, and then we went to, we ended up with a much smaller office. And I'm so glad, because we're going to need even probably smaller space in the future, because now that we can be more virtual, and this has kind of proven it. And we still need office space, but in that regard, it's been really good. And we've also diversified in our offerings too. So we've, because like we've said before, working with manufacturers and doing different platforms. So it gives us more tentacles out there to be able to be serviceable and find opportunities.
Yeah, when you say that you were in the middle of a long pivot, I know I keep saying this, but I think a lot of companies are just accelerating in a direction they already knew they needed to go, right? I mean, this just, it became an impetus to do it. They already knew it was there. I don't think a lot of people changed direction so much as they just accelerated into what they knew was coming, you know?
I think that those that were fortunate did, and then there were some that are still waking up to saying, oh, what's next?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And unfortunately, I think some of those, the turn may be too hard now, you know, or are not happening quick enough to be sustainable, you know, in the short term. I do find, you're right. I think the people that had their eyes open, that were kind of looking at that future landscape and making plans of how they took the 5 or 6 steps to get over where they knew they needed to go. They already had the map, and now it was just, okay, now we need to go. It's no longer a long journey. Throw your suitcase in the car. we're heading out.
As much as it wasn't easy, and I still would prefer to have had more work, more paying work to do, we used a lot of this time to be able to build infrastructure and to be able to position ourselves for the future. And I think many other companies also were thinking along the same lines. So coming out of it, we're going to be a much stronger company, which, you know, I hope is going to pay off in seeing the market demand increase and seeing that where we focused our efforts are going to align with what people are needing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's smart. And I think for businesses out there that are still in a position to make those changes, like if they're hesitant, maybe that gives them the courage to jump towards what they thought, you know, they needed to be doing, because you never know. Like you said, we don't know. We don't know when the full, what the future looks like. So.
Well, it also feels like we're in a period of like anything goes, why not? Yeah. You know, because I think even, I mean, not everything, but almost everything you're doing right now is a risk, right? Because so much is like Steve kind of alluded to, everything you're doing is a risk because everything is changing every day. And no one really does know what is the out of this look like, you know? And just even the talk about, what was the statistic I heard was that 40% of the workforce probably won't return to the office, I think was the number I heard, you know? And so is that number true? So
yeah.
Is that something I should address? And then, okay, fine. I invest in the infrastructure to support that statistic and oh, they're wrong. You know, it's like, you know,
yeah, but I think that's all just making decisions based on best data, right? Like you can't overjudge those decisions. I mean, like somebody may look at you, Jared, and go, Jared just spent money doing an awesome case study video. Like yep. Why? And then in 3 months, if there's, you know, if all of a sudden the wheels are coming off the company or there aren't enough jobs to bring somebody in, somebody's going to look at that and go, oh, that was, you know, Jim's job because Jared had to do a stupid video of the council chambers. Right. Like,
and they'll be like, there's never going to be a council chambers again after COVID.
Yeah.
What a waste of money.
Exactly. Right. So I think you're always going to have those critiques and those things. And as an owner, you have to look at, like, you know, you have to look at that. We can't go into such a retraction mode that once things do open up, if they do, that we're not in a position to take advantage of that opening, right? Like you have to reserve enough strength to take that final swing, and you have to be positioning yourself in a way that it makes sense to do it. And you can't turtle up, right? You can't just go in your shell and wait it out and hope that, you know, in a year or a year and a half, that you can just come back. You'll waste all of your resources maintaining yourself, and there won't be a business left to build. So I mean, at some point you have to take some of those risks and just be comfortable with the fact that you made the decisions based on your best instincts and your best knowledge, and they may not all work out perfect, right?
I think go ahead, Steve.
I enjoyed the fact that you guys talk about this, and that's actually one of the things that drew me to reaching out, is that we don't spend enough time talking about it, the business side of what we're doing, and especially when we're looking at it from a small business perspective.
You know, yeah,
bigger businesses I think are in a different category, but the small business owner that's wearing many hats and that has to be able to understand. Like Mark just mentioned, you know, I have a limited budget. Where do I put that money, or where do I put that effort? I mean, we all have limited time, and being able to say that I invested it in the right place, that's going to pay off. Many people look at that and they say, how do you know that that's going to work, why is that a good decision? And the you may not be able to provide that answer today. Have to go based on instinct, or based on seeing what, you know, trusting your gut, seeing what other people are finding to be effective, putting your ear to the ground. You know, there isn't a playbook.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that goes on when we're talking about leadership, Steve, and you were talking about this earlier. A lot of it also has to do with being able to reframe things for people within your company too. I remember going through recession when the home building industry started to drop like crazy in Arizona, and I was on the residential side, and you know, the housing bubble burst in 2007, right? Like 2007, 2008, not a great time for housing or to be dependent on new housing, which we were. And I had a couple of salespeople whose jobs at the time were sitting in a design center, and the home builder just sent people to them all day long that were building houses like that. They had no prospecting. They were inside sales. People showed up at their desk, sat down, spent 20 grand on AV and left in an hour. It was an hour meeting, and they left with a decision made like that. You know, that was the sale. And, you know, when 2007 hit, that just wasn't happening. I mean, there were no people coming through. You might have one person a day that came into your office. And so you know, I was as a leader, I wasn't a manager, but as a, as you know, kind of the senior salesperson and a leader trying to help them turn the corner on like, how do we find new business? You know, I sat down with a couple of folks. I'm like, hey, what we should be doing, we should be pulling every single, you know, we have a, an accounting system here. We have a part number for a home theater pre-wire and for a patio pre-wire and for all these things, a security pre-wire. We need to be pulling every single pre-wire SKU we've ever sold, calling those customers, ask them how their life in their new house is going, asking if they ever completed this system that they pre-wired for and seeing if we have the opportunity to go in there and complete the system right now. Cause that's how we're going to generate revenue. And they were resistant. Like people get resistant. And so for me, it was the reframe. And I had to say, you know, I get it. It's not what you were hired here to do. It's not what you're used to doing every day. And it's different. It's a different job. But I said, but unfortunately, you know, you were hired to do inside sales and we have no one coming inside. I said, but the good news is we are hiring for outside salespeople right now and you are first in line. And this is what the job entails. Like, I don't have an inside salesperson position because I don't have anybody coming through the door of this business, but I do have the desire to grow our business and I need outside salespeople. I like you. I think you have the aptitude to do this job. I'd like you to try it. And you know, this is the way that we're going to be successful. And it wasn't like, yeah, we're going to fire you, but it was really somewhat of a funny way to do a little bit of a wake up call that the job we hired you for just isn't here.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to say it any different than that.
And you're trying, right? Yeah. You're trying, but you need their participation.
Yeah.
And if they don't participate, that's okay. But guess what?
Yeah. Yeah. Then somebody else may choose to participate and I have to go that direction. Yeah. I think that as a business owner, that whole idea of being able to create the proper frame for the moment in time that the business is going through really helps forge people around like, okay, I get it now. I get the mission and I get the battlefield. If we're doing the military thing, Jared, I get the mission. I get the battlefield. I'm confident in the leader. They're asking me to do something that's a little out of my comfort zone. But now that I can see the bigger picture, I'm willing to go do that. Right. So.
Yeah, I kind of look, you know what I do is, and I don't know, again, I don't know if this is the right way, but one way that I judge what I'm doing as well is I look at what others are investing in the sense of who drive, of people that drive the market, you know? And so I kind of play the odds that way where I go, well, if manufacturers X and Y and Z are all releasing these products still, and they're still pushing this, it's almost like there's too much investment for everyone to let this fail, you know? And so I kind of, some of my bias or some of my direction is taken from, if there's so many people that are invested in making this work, then it's going to, you know, I don't know if that is the right way. And that's just a part of what I take my view on, but.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, I think there's a little to be said for that. I would also say that, you know, many times people have trouble letting go of something that they've invested in. So the other side of this is this idea that
you're not wrong.
You read of sunk costs, right? So there's this idea of sunk costs. We all have a pair of shoes in our closet or a pair of pants that don't fit that we paid $150 for that we will never throw away because we paid $150 for them. But the net value of that item is zero. We will never use it. It will never be used again. We can't fit into it, but there's a sunk cost, right? And
I call that pot committed.
Right? The analogy I used to remember on this was you buy tickets to a football game, right? So you buy tickets to a football game, and the reason you bought tickets to a football game is because you thought it was going to be fun to go to the football game in person with your friends and blah, blah, blah. Then the day comes and it's a blizzard and your friends call and say they're not going and you've got $150 invested into tickets in the football game. Do you go sit in the snow by yourself and be miserable for 3 hours? Or do you stay at home in your living room and do you watch TV, invite your buddies over and have your tailgate party there? And most people will go to the game and sit and be miserable because they paid $150 for the tickets. Whereas the actual net result is they spend $150 to have a bad time. The $150 is spent.
The only
so now it is what do I get the most value out of doing today, the $150 isn't coming back either way. So like when you say this about manufacturers, yeah, if they have a 6-year process into developing this product and it was supposed to launch right now and they're launching it and marketing has already spent all the dollars, they're just going to throw it out there. The cost is there. Let's throw it out and see what happens. You know,
the only difference in your story and in the business world is that at least you can look out the window and see the weather and you know a storm is coming.
Yeah.
So true. You know to stay inside, but in the business case, you don't have a weather well, I guess you have the reports and the information you have is almost just as accurate as weather.
Yes.
The other problem could be that you see the weather report, but everybody else on your team doesn't.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was one of my definitions of an entrepreneur is that you see things that other people don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen the movie Margin Call, Steve?
I haven't. No.
Have you, Jared?
No.
So there's a movie called Margin Call.
It's Bruce Willis, isn't it?
No, he's not. I forget all the people in it, but Jeremy Irons is like the CEO of this company, and the wheels are about to fall off the economy. Right. So it's about the crash in 2007, 2008. And he's seeing the wheels start turning on the whole thing about to collapse just completely.
Right.
And they're trying to push their people to sell things and get things out and be a little unethical because they know it's coming. And one of the guys asks him like how he knows. Right. And he's the CEO of the company. He's like, hey, I can't do this and I can't do that. And I can't do that. He goes, but my job is to hear the music, and the music is playing. You know, like he's like, that's his job. Like I'm the one who hears the music, like when nobody else does, right? It's such a great little line when he says it, but it's totally true. Like that's the job of the business owner, right? Is to be in tune with that environment and to maybe see and hear something that people don't, that just doesn't feel quite right, and start to make sure that they're hedging for that.
That sounds like too much pressure. I don't want
too much pressure.
Well, I don't want to be part of this anymore. I want to go back to the turtle guy that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Just get back in your shell. Just get back in your shell, everybody. Yeah. It'll just, you know, hunker down, be one of those, African frogs that digs itself into the mud for the dry season. And then when it starts raining again, you emerge and you're fine. All the frogs are gone. No, they're still down there somewhere. Hey,
so Steve, are you going to cut us off there, Mark? You're not going to cut us off.
I was going to, but you can ask one last
question. No, I have one last question. Perfect. One last question. Then you have to, you got to go.
Then I can wrap. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the bonus round. So Steve, you started in 97 and my assumption is that you started, you yourself are technical, like you're a programmer yourself. Is that right? So what would you say? And I'm in the same boat, where I was a technician when this all started, what would you say has been the biggest challenge and how did you overcome it in the 23 years? You have twice as, actually, side note, today is our 9-year anniversary here at Hillman.
Nice. So
that's, I keep forgetting that, but what would you say has been the biggest challenge in going from the guy that's in that trench and doing the work to the guy that has to let other people do it the way they want to do it? And then leading that team, what's the biggest challenge and how did you find that you overcame that?
So the two challenges that you just mentioned is one is, you know, hiring a staff and being able, and that's ongoing, that's on and managing, but then also coming the day that I decided, hey, you know what? I can't wear these two big hats. I can't be a programmer doing projects and run a business, and being able to come to grips with that, being able to take that risk, because basically I'm now giving up what got me here and I'm now putting all the faith in everybody else, because quite honestly, for me to go back to doing programming now would be a tall order. I've been away from it for so long. I understand it. I just couldn't do it. But the ability to have the confidence in doing that, and then also gain the trust of your team, because my team was strictly technical. We didn't have anybody in a sales role or anything like that. We had one administrative person. They now looked at me as a different person because they said, like, you're not one of us anymore. You're not the one that's going into battle with us. You're not the one that does what we do. So now you're not going to understand us as much. And I, that's why I always try to keep one foot in the water there to be able to be relatable to my team and understand what they do. Cause I think that's really important. But that was probably one of the biggest fears. And then just growth and just the risk of making the big decisions and knowing that you don't necessarily know what the outcome is, but and you need to everybody to invest in you,
and that you have 10 families in your charge.
Yeah.
Which is semi accurate. It's not the truth, but it's how you feel.
Yeah.
Oh, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I'm sure some people that impacts them less than others, but most small businesses are more family oriented, and I think that's it keeps you up at night.
Yeah,
yeah. That's always been the one thing that I knew would weigh on me, and probably one of the reasons that I've never, been brave enough to do what the two of you have done and start my own thing is that. I take that very personally, and I don't know that I'd be able to handle it. Like if I had to, if I knew somebody depended on me and I had to let them go, or I had to, things didn't work out. Like I've had to fire two people in my life, and it was both of them were like, I'm crying with them, as we're talking about it, it was really hard, and especially when the one that I had was especially hard because I knew she didn't have the platform for success that she needed, and that we were relying on her to be a very, very self-starter, and that she needed some handholding, and she needed about 2 months, and she would have been amazing in the role, and we just didn't have the time or the resources to give it to her. So it's kind of one of those things, like I almost felt like we should have never brought her in if we knew we didn't have the time to develop her the way that she needed. We just kind of put her out on a ledge and waited for her to fall off, and I don't like doing that to people in general in life. But that was a really rough one. That was 15 years ago, and I'm still like getting emotional about it right now. But
anyways, still draws a tear.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, hey guys, I'm sorry to cut short, but
we're
pushing limits. Got some other meetings today, but Steve, I'm really happy that we got to do this. I mentioned when you contacted me that you were somebody I've known about and known for a while, like casually, yep. and this is the longest conversation you and I have ever had in the years that we've known each other. And I'm really happy that you reached out and we were able to do it. And now I know we can talk for half an hour to an hour at InfoComm or wherever we get to next time and have a great conversation. So I appreciate that. Jared, thanks as always, my man. Braving the winters.
Good. Yep. Cool. I braved the winter here.
Thank you guys. I appreciate this. It's a lot of fun, and I'm glad we got a chance to speak. Maybe we'll do it again.
Awesome. Well, hey, everybody, thanks for joining us on AV Daybreak. And as always, we'll be back next week. Take care.